Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight we have a great interview for you guys, one of the best that we've done, certainly in this Oscar nominee interview series, with Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith, the writers-directors of The Most Dangerous Man in America, which is nominated for Best Documentary this year. And we're happy to bring you the show. Before we get to the interview, though, we got some news to talk about.
We got a lot of news to talk about, actually. It's the anti-Hurt Locker. You know, that's all. I just can't. I mean, I do believe it, but it's just this is every day. Like every morning when I wake up and check like my email, or, you know, like the Wrap and IMDb. There's a new story.
Yeah.
It's outrageous. But why don't you go ahead and tell the folks what we're talking about here?
Well, the news from today. Of course, we told you about the producer of the Hurt Locker, one of the producers, the main money guy that. I guess you could factor it as being a newbie to the business and the Oscars. He sent out a mass email to potential voters and saying, you know, essentially vote for us. We're the underdog against the billion-dollar behemoth Avatar.
Right.
If you want to see more movies like ours, vote for us. And it was, you know, and he was very, very not subtle at all about it.
No, he wasn't.
The Oscar committee was trying to decide what punishment to impose upon him in response to this, and they decided to ban him from the ceremony.
Yeah, just an outright ban.
Producer Nicolas Chartier, that's his name. So he is not able to attend. But if you remember, the Hurt Locker had four producers, and they could only accept like three on stage or something.
Right. I think
so. So they still got a third producer they can bring up there with
them. Yeah. But I think there's already a dinner being hosted in his honor, though.
Yeah.
So I mean, he's not like he'll be all right. You know. I mean, but no, it was a stupid mistake. I can't say I might have done the same thing had I been in his shoes. I'm not sure. But it was stupid, and I don't know. The word on the street is like this was just really over the top on the Academy's part to do this. But you know, who am I to say, you know, what the Academy thinks, how they think, or whatever. This is what they felt was the appropriate thing. So I don't know. But that's not all.
Yeah, that isn't all.
Yeah.
There's a lawsuit. There's a lawsuit now, you know, against the makers of the Hurt Locker by an Army bomb disposal expert who claims that Jeremy Renner, his character in the film, is based upon him,
mm-hmm.
and that Mark Boal, the screenwriter of the project, had extensive visits and conversations with him. And those conversations almost fully informed Jeremy Renner's character and the film, right down to the phrase "the Hurt Locker," which this Army, this bomb disposal expert, claims that he came up with. So he's suing.
Yeah, he is suing them. I mean, oh, I don't, you know. It's all coming out now. I mean,
yeah, it's all coming out now, a day after the ballots were due.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure a lot of ballots were already turned in.
Yeah, yeah.
Prior to Tuesday. So I don't know what effect it has, if any, but It is something else. It is, you know, we always talk about movies when they announce the nominees up to the award ceremony and the time span where perceptions of some of these films can change drastically. We
right.
saw that with Up in the Air is the most drastic example, I think, from this year.
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah, that was the frontrunner, and now, boom, it's, you know, no one's really talking. Maybe with the exception of
screenplay.
Screenplay, yeah. So.
So it's interesting. So now this is pretty much the most heated backlash I've seen in a while.
Yeah, no, it is. It's the other thing about the Hurt Locker. There's all the articles that have been popping up, like in the Washington Post, the New York Times, how all the soldiers are saying it's inaccurate, like it's not really like that.
Right.
So you have all that to contend with the last couple of weeks as well. I haven't seen anything quite like this. But there's just been this campaign against it, and we've speculated, I think, on the last show who might be behind this or what it might be. But it's just it's outrageous, really.
Yeah. Well, if this Oscar year is somewhat predictable, which I think it is, it's very mm-hmm. predictable, at least it throws something different and it throws some uncertainty into the mix.
Yeah.
You know, so at least maybe there'll be a surprise in the Best Picture category of all things.
I think it's the Best Picture and the Best Director are where the surprises are going to be. I actually think director is going to be a surprise, too. It has the potential to be a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Best Director is a lock, actually. But I would not be upset if it wasn't.
No, I wouldn't be upset, but I just think those are the two. But I think the Best Picture is the one that everyone, because there's a lot of possibilities that the two major ones could, you know, cancel each other out and that could leave the way for something else. So... we'll see. But I think it is in the acting categories. I just don't see them being different from all the other awards that have been handed out. You know, I just don't see there being any upsets. Now, if there are, I'd welcome that. But
yeah.
I just don't see it. I really don't see that right now.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting... I hope to God it'll be an interesting race. Because the show's not looking good. I mean, it's just... still not looking very good. Every little morsel I hear about what they're doing. If you don't want to hear spoilers about the ceremony, then close your ears now.
Yeah, really. Just go ahead and watch Nip Tuck.
Because they're opening the ceremony. It's going to open with a silhouette of two men. And those two men aren't going to be the co-hosts. Aren't going to be Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin. They're going to be Neil Patrick Harris and Martin Short, who will come out and do a musical number together.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's a step up from Snow White and Rob Lowe.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Because if you recall, I mean, I love Martin Short. Neil Patrick Harris.
Like both of them. I think it's
Neil Patrick Harris has proven his mettle as a host, but,
you know,
in terms of film, we're talking, you know, a legacy of Clifford and Harold and Kumar. So...
That's
the only time we've ever mentioned Clifford on this show.
Well, that's true. I would never even think to mention Clifford, but you have. You've done it. You dropped that one.
So, you know, I don't know. I guess I'll just wait and see.
I'm going to TiVo, the Indie Spirit Awards. I'm really hoping there's some that's interesting.
Oh, that's always fun, the Indie
that's
Spirit.
Great. Those are great award shows, so I'm just hoping that those are good.
Those are Friday night.
Yeah, those are Friday night at 8 o'clock, I think, Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah.
And then it's like they start at 5, I guess, on Pacific Time.
Right.
So,
now, they normally air on the day before the Oscars under a tent on the beach. And this is the first
year.
Yeah, they moved it to an auditorium and to a Friday night.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it should be interesting.
That should be.
Makes it just like every other damn award show.
Yeah, it really
does. Yeah, there's that Indie Spirit.
There you go. Oh, my God.
Meanwhile, go ahead.
No, I just like, you know, we have these two last award shows, but obviously the Oscars is the big one. And like we said, there's probably no surprises. I hope so, but as you said, I hope something different happens.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Your phone's clicking.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. My phone sucks.
Okay.
I think.
Well, two movies open this weekend of movies of note. Alice in Wonderland and Brooklyn's Finest. Brooklyn's Finest, which is a title that's actually been shelved for a while, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's got a great cast: Richard Gere, Ethan Hawke, Wesley Snipes, Don Cheadle. It's Antoine Fuqua,
mm-hmm.
who did Training Day.
Yeah, so that has potential, I think, but I haven't really heard much about it. It's the other movie that opens that I've heard nothing.
Reviews have been lukewarm on it.
Oh, okay, really? Okay, I haven't read any yet, so I don't know.
Yeah. But the other movie, obviously, is Alice in Wonderland.
And the reviews have been nothing short of savage.
They have. I mean, I haven't really read one glowing review of it.
I know, I haven't either. It sounds like it's really a mess. And at the same time, probably.
They say it's uninspired, not particularly visionary.
Right, I know.
Or imaginative.
Mm-hmm.
And really sloppy use of 3D. First of all, this is one of those movies where they never intended it to be in 3D, I don't think. Actually, Tim Burton was approached at the beginning to shoot it in 3D, and he thought it would be too labor-intensive. And so he decided, we'll just convert it to 3D after we shoot it. So unlike Avatar, a lot of these movies that are playing in 3D weren't shot in the format. They were transferred to the format.
Oh, great. Okay. Mm.
Yeah. There's a reason for that. Part of it is creatively, like I said, too labor-intensive. And another part of it is cost. I mean, it's much cheaper to convert it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Apparently.
Yeah. Well, you have this, and then you have Clash of Titans. I hear from what people have seen of Clash of Titans in 3D, it actually looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Alice in Wonderland, I just have not read a single good thing about the film. I mean, usually Tim Burton is mixed to positive, but this is not even mixed. This is just strictly negative reviews of the film. I mean, I'm really, really shocked. But, I mean, like we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, the trailer just is a very uninspired trailer. So, who knows?
Yeah. They say it doesn't tap into the subtext of the Alice in Wonderland stories,
okay.
The two books, it kind of fails to get the deeper meaning of those books.
Right.
And, you know, it's very surface, which, you know, a lot of Tim Burton movies are for me.
Remakes, yeah, they definitely are.
But from a visual standpoint, that's what shocks me the most about the criticisms against the film.
Right.
But it's still going to be huge. It's still going to have a huge opening and second weekend, probably.
Yeah, I think so. I think it'll do well. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But it might have some stiff competition the following week with Green Zone and some other films that are opening. I mean, as we get into March, there's a lot of, like, potentially big titles coming out. But
Well, Green Zone is getting good notices. The only complaint I've heard about it is that they're a little tired of the Paul Greengrass shaky cam.
Yeah, my thing with that is, as much as I'm looking forward to the movie and I like the book it's based on, you got to convince people it's not Bourne, the fourth Bourne
mm-hmm.
movie, I guess, with that combo. And I mean, it's not. I don't mean it as criticism. It just means you got to let people know that's not. It's not another Bourne film.
Well, I don't know if you do have to do that. My resistance to the movie and my surprise that they chose this movie to do together is because it shares a lot of similarities with Bourne.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of marketing, the Bourne movies are so damn popular.
Yeah. Oh,
that I think it's smart to kind of market it as another one.
People might be, you know, if they are expecting it, they might be disappointed. I honestly don't know. But, no, like you said, so far the notices have been good. So I'm looking forward to that. And there's some other stuff coming out. But yeah, I think
well, speaking of disappointment,
Harrison
Ford confirmed that there's a germ of an idea for a fifth Indiana Jones film, which we had heard that previously from Shia LaBeouf.
We've heard that a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah. He says that he and Spielberg and Lucas have come up with a rough outline for the next one that they've agreed upon. But the finished product might take a long time because it goes to George Lucas, and then George Lucas does whatever he can to ruin it before it goes to back to Steven Spielberg. Even so, I mean, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, as much as people were disenchanted by it, it still made like $500 million.
Yeah.
You know, it's... So, you know,
well, maybe they'll have something. Maybe they'll have something to work with. Who knows? I, you know, it took so long to get the last one. I'm not holding my breath. I'm really not holding my breath because they're all got different things to do. So, we'll check Harrison Ford. I don't know what he's doing, but
Extraordinary Measures too.
There you go. There, I knew that was coming.
Extraordinarier Measures. Also, the HBO. You know, HBO. They're doing great stuff. I mean, they've enlisted Scorsese to do a series for them, and he already shot the pilot, and that airs soon. They have The Pacific, which is their big World War II movie, Tom Hanks and Spielberg producing. They've got Pacino in the Jack Kevorkian story, directed by Barry Levinson. They're enlisting all of this great talent. There's one talent that we've always thought perfect for HBO, and his two shows, Deadwood and John from Cincinnati, just failed to ignite on the network. And that's David Milch.
Yeah.
David Milch of NYPD Blue fame. Of you know, so he's perfect for that format in HBO. He has another idea about horse racing, I believe, that has gotten the green light. And he has cast as his lead on this HBO series, none other than Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That'd be great.
And the pilot to the show will be directed by Michael Mann.
Okay, yeah. Okay, all right, I remember reading. All right, I remember about Michael Mann wanting to do something. Okay, that's great.
So Hoffman, one of our great actors, is moving to series television.
But it's HBO, so, I mean, it's like...
It's not TV.
It's HBO. There you go. No, it's gonna be. They got a lot of great stuff in the works there. So, and that's where you got. That's I think in between TV and film, that's like one of the best places to go to try something new. I really do believe that. There's a lot of great stuff there. So, there is life after The Sopranos, big time. So.
Yeah. I think so too. Conan is being made. By Marcus Nespel.
Yeah, and Mickey Rourke plays Daddy. And,
Did
you hear who the villain may be?
Yeah, remind me.
Stephen Lang.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, he'd be a great villain in that.
Well, yeah, he's been it before.
Yeah.
In Avatar, so...
Yeah,
he's
perfect for it.
He's a good guy. I don't know if you saw this. James Cameron was on Inside the Actor's Studio the other night.
Really?
Yeah, and Stephen Lang was in the audience. And
oh, okay.
Spent some time talking in between each other. It was a good show. There's something about James Cameron. I think that when people look at James Cameron, they see a man of enormous ego.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they probably just assume this is probably as arrogant as they come. So it seems like he goes out of his way in interviews and such to be as down to earth and kind of complimentary as possible.
Yeah, that is, and he's also, there's one other thing. He's incredibly bright. I mean, when it comes to science and everything,
genius.
Guy is really super intelligent. He knows his stuff when it comes to physics, astronomy, just every part of science. I mean, it's amazing just hearing him speak and reading interviews with him. He really knows his stuff. It's amazing. That's why there's such a technological edge in his movies. I mean, he really knows what he's talking about. I always find that fascinating.
Yeah, well, we mentioned Neil Patrick Harris coming out the first of the Oscars. Actually, he just got a lead in a movie.
Yes, he did. The original Blue People.
That's right. The Smurfs. He's the lead live-action character in The Smurfs.
Well,
wow.
That's, you know, hopefully Harold and Kumar will be in it.
That's a brave man right there.
That is a very brave man. What the hell, the Smurfs? What the hell do we need a Smurf for? Oh my god. Oh
yeah.
Dear god. Who's directing? Do we know who's directing it?
Oh, I don't care. It doesn't matter, really.
No, it's like Luc Besson or somebody, or
Luc Besson's The Smurfs.
I would. That would be an awesome movie.
Wow. And of course, the Arthur remake is being done with Russell Brand. They're moving ahead on that.
Oh wow!
It's going to be directed by the director of the TV series Modern Family.
God, that show and everyone associated with that show is just really picking up steam. I mean,
yeah, and it's written by one of the writers of Borat.
Yeah. So. Okay. Well, I didn't know Arthur remake.
Yeah, I just don't. Arthur's one of the funniest movies for me.
No, I mean, that's a great cast. I mean, Dudley Moore and John Gielgud, and he's just the. I don't know.
Well, apparently, oh, who was it? That's playing the Gielgud part. It's going to be, I think. I know. It's Meryl Streep.
You're joking, right?
No, I'm not.
No, because I would have said Malcolm McDowell should play the. Gielgud part, but okay.
You know, Meryl Streep is taking Hobson's role.
Oh my god. Meryl Streep and Russell. Wow. That is quite a combo.
Yeah. I don't know. I
really don't know about that. Wow. Okay.
I hate to be close-minded and precious about.
You're not being close-minded. It's just it's, you know, there's a, all right. Look, I mean, all right, that remake I can sort of see. There's another remake coming out to a movie that's less than 3 years old, Death at the Funeral, which
right.
is a British comedy, and they remade it with Chris Rock. I mean, there's a great cast in the remake and everything, but it's like I'm watching a trailer, and the trailer is the exact same trailer of the British film.
Isn't it directed by Neil LaBute?
Oh my God, he's doing another remake? Oh
yeah,
God.
Isn't he directing that?
I think he is. Oh, my God. He's directing. You would think he'd learn his lesson with The Wicker Man. Oh, my God. Some of these guys.
Oh, that's right. That was Neil LaBute.
Oh, my God. Well, maybe a direct, flat-out comedy will do him good.
Yeah. An abomination.
He's a great director and a great playwright. Don't get me wrong. I mean, he's an incredible guy. But and Lakeview Terrace is all right, but The Wicker Man, that was just god-awful.
How did they not know that was god-awful?
What did the guy say when you're watching the dailies or whatever, or you see the rough cut, you're just like, this blows. I mean,
yeah.
This really sucks.
Even as they were doing it, how did they not know, with Nicolas Cage running around in a bunny suit or a bear suit or whatever he was wearing, how did they not know that they were doing something completely ridiculous?
Yeah, and my thing is how someone as bright as Neil LaBute, how does he, like, even, you know, show up to the set and do that, you know, and direct those scenes and not realize, hey, this is really beneath me.
Right.
This is really beneath me. You know, look at all the other stuff that he's written, and especially, like, something he made that, I think, after The Shape of Things, which is just brilliant, and to do that, and it's just like, what are you doing? I know the paycheck, and, you know, I know I can't say I wouldn't do the same thing in those shoes. The paycheck must be very tempting, but it's just the material is so beneath you, and the original is very good, and this one is just really bad.
Well, he has a very particular voice.
He does.
A very particular style. So if you look at his first three films, in The Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbors, and The Shape of Things, all very similar.
Nurse Betty is the third. Would be the third one. Shape.
All right. Well, take that out.
Okay. Remember, Possession. There's also Possession. He's in that.
You're ruining my argument.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up now.
If you look at that, if those movies, I mean, they're all very strong male-female relationships.
Yeah.
There's investigations of misogyny and all that kind of stuff within all of those.
Right.
And they're talking head movies. I mean, they're talkies. So maybe he looked at his career and said, I want to be a filmmaker. I don't want to be pigeonholed like this. I want to do other people's material. I want to cross genres. It seems like that started with like Nurse Betty and Possession, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that did start with those.
And I think he needs to get back to the indie spirit that he
once had. I think he does. I think he does. I agree with you. But we'll see what happens with this on Death at the Funeral. I mean, look, the cast they have for the remake is a great cast and everything. But, you know, it's really disconcerting. You're watching the trailer, and it's just like, it's not even so much that you know now the movie's going to be scene for scene, but the trailer is exactly like the original trailer. And it's like, wow, come on. I mean, I don't know.
Well, before we get to our next to our interview for this evening, got a special treat for everyone.
Oh my god! I know, it's a dead silence on the line.
Yeah, we've been playing film scores a lot lately, and I got a special one for everyone to listen to tonight. Might be your first time hearing it because the movie hasn't even come out yet. But it will Friday. This is a piece of Danny Elfman's score from Alice in Wonderland, and it is pretty wonderful. So we'll play this, and then we'll see on the other side of this to present our Oscar nominee interviews for this evening.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
Okay, that's Danny Elfman's score from Alice in Wonderland. The score is very promising. I think it's cool.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's a good score. Man.
Yeah, it's definitely Danny Elfman has his own sound.
Yeah,
and no one really replicates that. But he and Burton, everybody talks about the Johnny Depp Burton collaboration, but Danny Elfman's been good for Tim Burton and vice versa.
Yeah, without a doubt.
If you think of those great scores, and he really, you know, Danny Elfman's history. I mean, that he came from Oingo Boingo, baby, and you know, Batman exploded, and then he was brought on to do Edward Scissorhands and Dick Tracy. Dick Tracy's a good score too.
Yeah, that is. That's a very good score.
I think the only time that Burton's ever gone with someone outside of Danny Elfman, I don't know this for sure, is Ed Wood when he used Howard Shore.
Well, also, isn't it Sweeney Todd as well? Or
Well, yeah.
Obviously, yeah. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think.
Yeah. So that's a good score, and I think that's available in stores now. Okay. You ready to get to our interview?
Yeah, I am. Definitely.
Okay. The Most Dangerous Man in America. It tells the story of Daniel Ellsberg, a former Pentagon insider who chooses to disclose a cabinet full of classified documents to the press in an effort to challenge an imperial presidency and inspire an end to the Vietnam War. This is a great documentary. It's a very important story. And it's finally being brought to the screen, and brought to the screen very vividly by writers-directors Rick Goldsmith and Judith Ehrlich. Here's a trailer to give you a little sense of the film.
We are going to win. Quit making national heroes out of those who steal secrets and publish them in the newspaper.
The hundreds of thousands we were killing was unjustified homicide. And I couldn't see the difference between that and murder. Murder had to be stopped.
This weekend, portions of a highly classified Pentagon document came to light for all the world to see, brought cries of outrage from Washington.
We got to get this son of a bitch.
Yes, Kennedy did send in troops in violation of the Geneva Accord. Johnson did start the buildup before he said he was going to. These guys were lying through their teeth when they were talking to us. And here it is in black and white. There's no way of denying it.
The Times building is encircled by armed guards. We are printing tomorrow a top secret government document.
A name has now come out as the possible source of the Times Pentagon document. It is that of Daniel Ellsberg, the top policy analyst for the Defense and State Department.
I am prepared to answer to all the consequences of these decisions.
Henry Kissinger said that Daniel Ellsberg was the most dangerous man in America, and he had to be stopped.
The study was 47 volumes, 7,000 pages. It would take me months of Xeroxing.
We have dropped another 200,000 tons of bombs on Indochina. That's 10 Hiroshimas. One Hiroshima a week.
What has remained significant about the release of the Pentagon Papers is the decision by a public official to give priority to conscience as compared to career.
Daniel Ellsberg, whatever his intentions, gave aid and comfort to the enemy.
It was a crime from the start, carried out by four presidents, and now a fifth president was doing the same.
I'm not going to be part of this system of lying anymore.
It wasn't that we were on the wrong side. We were the wrong side.
Okay, that's the trailer to The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, nominated for Best Documentary this year. And we had the great pleasure of speaking to the directors of the film, Judith Ehrlich and Rick Goldsmith. And in this interview, they share their experiences of making the film and the themes within the film that continue to resonate today, and the excitement they share over the film's nomination. Here they are.
I I'm trying not to get too bent out of shape about who's going to win, who's going to win. You know, it's I know it's going to be an exciting event. I've actually been to the Oscars before, which is not to say that, oh, it's all, you know, I'm very blasé about this. Like, oh, this happens all the time. But, you know, I do know a little bit what to expect. And, you know, it should be a fun ride. There's a ton of events in the week leading up. So.
Right.
At any rate, it should be good.
Well, with the documentary category, it works a bit differently from the other categories in that it's announced that you're on the short list of nominees,
right.
In advance. So that's like an extra pressure, I would think. That would be extra nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I would think you would grab the Xanax immediately to try to just calm yourself down. I mean, whatever.
Right, right. Right. Well, there should be. I mean, there should be a lot of drugs involved in this.
Always. I don't know. Let me tell you this.
I think that's one of the, that's my character. I don't know, positively or negatively, but I probably should play more drugs in this. Since
I think we all should. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
But I don't know how you guys do it. I mean, you have this month window where you are nominated. You find that, and it's an awesome achievement right there. But then you got, oh my God, and, you know, for the next month you're like walking on a wire, a good wire, but still, I mean,
right, right. Well, the thing is that, you know, you're filled up with all these you know, obligations, and you know, you have to schedule things, and you have to get your tux, and you have to get the, you know, figure out the tickets, and you have to do, you know, all these things. I mean, I spent just 2 hours programming my iPhone with all my scheduled events between Wednesday and Sunday. So it's like, oh, what is this about again? Oh, yeah, we did a film. That's right. We did a film. Oh, yeah.
The movie is incredible, and it's such an important story on so many levels, so many reverberations throughout history that this story carries. What shocked me about it primarily at first was the fact that Daniel Ellsberg's story had not been told in the documentary form yet. He had to have been approached at some point by others, I would think.
He had been approached by several others, and at the time that we started the film, there were several others who were interested, and it took us 6 months to convince the Ellsbergs that we were the right one. But why 35 years later? I mean, it just seemed like he really didn't want to tell the story until he had written the book about his life, which is called Secrets. And and we were really lucky to have that book to work from, because it gave us a real basis for the structure of the film to a large extent, and some of the narration is taken from his own words in the book. So it gave us a score.
He wrote that book in 2002, I think,
correct.
Right?
That's right. And actually, it's not entirely accurate that other documentarians haven't approached him. He was approached shortly after the Pentagon Papers episode, and there was a very fine film that we drew on a little bit in our own film called Conversations with Daniel Ellsberg. It was made in 1972 while he was awaiting trial. But this is the and then there was yet another film, blanking on the name, but it's also briefly in our film. And but since that event, this is the first documentary treatment.
Well, it seems apropos that the film is coming now when it is, because there are the obvious parallels to what we're dealing with on the Iraq front and Afghanistan.
I would think especially Afghanistan in the last 4 months,
yeah.
Just because of the cable, there were the Eikenberry cables or whatever, in November.
Good, you know about that.
No,
impressive.
I know about that. And
yeah.
I'm sorry, Jamie, if I am in any way interfering with what you're
saying. No, go ahead, please.
Oh, no. It's just that I read those a couple months ago because a friend of mine forwarded me the transcripts of what were said, and I mean, I have my own perspective of what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, but I'm like, if the Red Army and the British couldn't keep this area under control or couldn't do anything, what makes you think we can?
Mm-hmm.
And why are we there?
Yeah.
I don't understand why we're even over there. And this Eikenberry cables were like said those things, and even more so, we need to just dig up and get out of there.
And just to tell your audience who Eikenberry is, he's the ambassador to Afghanistan and was the head of the military command there, and very knowledgeable person. And it's almost an exact equivalent to the story we tell in the film of McNamara, who knows that the war is hopeless, knows, you know, talks to Dan on the plane, gets off the plane and walks up to the press and tells them everything's great and, you know, it's all good in Vietnam, and lies through his teeth, which is what Eikenberry did in hearings. And Dan and also Robert Greenwald Greenwald's organization are calling to get Eikenberry back on the stand, and really to, you know, with the knowledge that these documents have now been leaked, to tell the truth to the American people about what his opinion is about Afghanistan and what he told the president.
Is Greenwald's involved?
Greenwald's got the Afghanistan campaign, and we've been cooperating with him. And interviewed Dan and Matthew Ho, who's also a recent dissenter from the State Department.
Oh, that's great. I mean,
yeah.
Well,
and when you go online, the other thing that might be interesting to your audience is the Woody Harrelson did a promo for us. It's on YouTube. If you Google Woody Harrelson and Dan Ellsberg, you'll get it. It's a wonderful clips of the film and Woody talking about Dan being his hero and you know, encouraging people to go and see the film. It's a really nice little piece.
Well, with these parallels that we've been discussing to Mr. Ellsberg's story and what's happening today, I would imagine that would add an extra sense of urgency on his part to get his story out. Did he articulate that to you?
Well, I think that was actually the urgency that provoked Judy and me to start this project. The parallels with Iraq and Afghanistan in 2005 were so unmistakable,
mm-hmm.
that this story felt... we felt that this story had a lot to tell the American people, and we don't have to even mention Iraq or Afghanistan in our film, and we don't,
mm-hmm.
for people to get the parallels. And that's throughout the age spectrum. Young people especially get that this is a film about the present. It's not a film about the past. They totally get the parallels and, you know, ask questions and engage us in dialogue after the film from conservative communities to, you know, more bastions of liberalism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you embark on this project, obviously you want Mr. Ellsberg's involvement. So tell me about that first meeting and what clicked between the three of you.
Well, you know, I had Rick and I both knew Dan a little bit. He lives right near us, which was a godsend for making a film that took years to make. So he was just up the hill, and we spent a lot of time in his basement looking at pictures and, you know, interviewing Dan and Patricia at their house. But I had done an earlier film for PBS, for ITVS, the same funder that funded this film, called The Good War and Those Who Refused to Fight It. It was about pacifists in World War II. And a mutual friend of Dan and mine introduced me to Dan and said, if you want to know about World War II, you have to talk to Dan Ellsberg. So I took him out to breakfast at this place he goes every day, and he talked through breakfast, through lunch, until 3 in the afternoon about World War II. And I filled 2 legal pads with notes and decided at that moment I wanted to do something about him, but I was in the middle of this other film, so it took me a couple of years to get back to that. And then Rick had met Dan already, so you can tell that part, Rick.
Dan was actually in a previous film that I did called Tell the Truth and Run, George Seldes and the American Press. It was about a muckraking journalist who really stepped outside the mainstream and criticized the censorship and suppression in the mainstream press. And Dan knew him, actually didn't know him personally, but knew his work and read him when he was a student at Harvard, when Ellsberg was a student at Harvard in 1950. So he was in that film, and it was easy to approach him, you know, from my point of view. So I think that, you know, we each had calling cards, Judy with The Good War and me with Tell the Truth and Run. And then we saw Dan and Patricia, actually, at a local high school doing an event on stage, just the two of them each sitting in a chair and talking about this very time period, the Pentagon Papers time period. And it was really a captivating conversation. And we understood then that we not only had a really terrific look into history, but we had a love story right there in front of us as well.
That's one of the surprising elements of your film, because it's shooting on so many different levels. It's a very human story about personal sacrifice, and of course it's about the Vietnam War and the ramifications of that. But it's also about this relationship between he and his wife, and that within the first year of their marriage, he could have faced a long, long time in prison for this.
115 years.
A long time. Yeah. That is a long time.
That's a long time.
He'd be getting out now. With good behavior, he'd be getting out about now.
Wow. Yeah,
yeah. When did it occur to you that this was going to be play a role in your documentary?
Well, that, as Rick said, that was very early, that particular thing. I think some things came, the original, because we get funding from public agencies, we don't go in with just a little outline. We go in with a pretty thorough treatment and a sense of where the story's going to go before we get any funding to start shooting. So, you know, we've done a lot of writing and reading and research and archive, sense of where the archival material's buried and all that by the time we get the camera out. But I think in that particular case, we really, we knew about the love story. The few things that came out late in the game were the story of Watergate. I think that was something we thought was tangential, but not as front and center, that the break into Dr. Fielding's office, into Dan Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, was really probably more important than the break into the Watergate complex, because that was the thing they could really track back to President Nixon. And that's what made Nixon crazy, going after Ellsberg and eventually destroying his own presidency because of the dirty tricks he played against Ellsberg and others. But it began, the Plumbers unit, with the attack on Dr. Ellsberg.
Mm-hmm. And you had if I understand correctly, you guys started with a 6-hour cut.
Yeah.
We started with all these things that Judy was just telling, but the first assembly was a 6-hour cut.
Right.
And when we sat down as a team to look at it over a couple of days, 2 or 3 days, and you know, we knew we had golden material.
Mm-hmm.
We just felt like we didn't, you know, we needed to not mess it up. And pick and choose and sculpt it to a story that really works. But because there were so many elements, I mean, because this transformation story and this crisis of conscience that Ellsberg went through was so powerful, we knew that was going to be the first part of the story. And as we interviewed other people, the journalists and the lawyers and the congressman and senator and his son and Tony Russo, we found that what Dan did, as he was provoked by Randy Keeler, the draft resister, his action had precipitated this kind of crisis of conscience of 8 or 10 or 12 other people, and so it becomes a really fascinating look into what do people do when they're confronted with a big moral question, and do I do the right thing? And some of them, you know, most of them did, and people like, Bud Krogh at the time didn't, but he has since, kind of seen how the error of his ways back in the Nixon administration, and you can see by the end of the film that he's a changed man as well.
Interesting that now Bud Krogh and John Dean and Ellsberg are all good buddies now.
Right.
So, you know, here are these guys who are arch enemies at the time who have all sort of had spiritual and political transformations and are on the same, you know, then now they lunch together.
it calls into question, we could use more Daniel Ellsbergs in the world today. I have two questions about Mr. Ellsberg and possibly your sense of how he feels about his role in history. Starting with the Most Dangerous Man in America title that was attributed to him by Henry Kissinger. Does he wear that like a point of a pride almost? How does he feel about that?
Well, we haven't really discussed it. I think he does. I mean, you know, the obvious context of what Kissinger was pointing to is he was dangerous to the people in power, and I think that's what Dan Ellsberg is all about. He's saying, you know, we've been playing follow the leader too long, and we can't leave these most important decisions of war and peace and governance and democracy to the person who's sitting in the executive chair. We don't have an imperial presidency, even though some of the presidents would like to think so. So, of course, he wears that with a badge of honor because that speaks to who he is.
And, you know, and I think one of the things about the title, which I've just been thinking about, today earlier was that I think the idea of this film is there's a lot of, it's got some dangerous ideas in it, primarily the idea that war is inevitable, and that one person can make a difference. Those are kind of dangerous ideas that you know, lots of people wouldn't like out there, because it's easier to just think you vote and go away and let the chips fall where they may. And
when you take into account the enormous sacrifice that he made with the Pentagon Papers, the release of the Pentagon Papers, and where we are now, do you think that apathy is our worst enemy now?
Well, you know, I think Dan talks a lot about the one thing he quotes Mike Gravel often, saying, asking Gravel, is the Congress extraordinarily cowardly right now? And Gravel responds, no, just ordinarily cowardly. And I think that, you know, it's not in the fabric of our society really for everyone to jump up and get involved. I mean, I think that it was during the Vietnam period when there was a draft and so many hundreds of thousands of young men and their mates and family were threatened by being dragged off to a war people weren't crazy about, that, you know, that definitely motivated people. Since that time, we haven't had that kind of mass movement, anti-war movement. But I think that there's a real sense of dissatisfaction at the moment, because people did get organized, did elect someone they thought was going to make a difference, and now people are feeling like, ooh, that didn't make a difference. Now what do we do? And I think the only answer to that is for reorganize those groups that got together and elected Obama and really ask for the change that we deserve and need and demand that of our Congress people, because, you know, it's just not going the way we had hoped it was,
right.
I think.
I do think that apathy is in my previous film, the journalist had a line, it was a key line in the film, apathy is the curse of our civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have fallen into a very apathetic civilization, the young and the old together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we grew up, I was 20 when the Pentagon Papers broke, we grew up at a time on the heels of the civil rights movement when anything was possible. You saw young people marching in Birmingham when they're high school students, when their parents were already put in jail, and kids sitting in on lunch counters, and kids risking their lives to register black people in the rural areas of Mississippi and Alabama, and that was inspiring. And by the time the Vietnam War came along, we, meaning my generation, knew that change was possible if people got together and demanded it and organized and went about it. There was hope. And I think that one we did in this film is to help reinstitute that hope, that change, and to that sense of apathy.
One thing I think is important to note, that I think when we talk about the film, we sound like it might be a dry polemic asking for people to go out to the barricades.
It's a thriller.
It doesn't read like that. I think that's the underlying message. When you leave the theater, we hope people are motivated. We don't hit them over the head with rallies every 30 seconds. Or, you know, it really reads as more going on this roller coaster ride with this guy who does change his life because he has a crisis of conscience and sees he's on the wrong side. But
a polemic. But I do want to add something. If Henry Kissinger criticizes you or calls you the most dangerous man in America, you must be doing something right, because there's a man who sold his soul to the devil.
And not we felt
the
a little
hardest man in American history, I think, in the 20th century at least. But he sold his soul to the devil. This is someone who fought heroically for his country, did everything, and then something went wrong. I mean, he really sort of. Christopher Hitchens can tell you all about that, and then there's the whole Hitchens question, too. What went wrong in 2002 when he decided to leave the nation and support the Iraq War? But, you know, for a brief time there, he was right that Kissinger had, you know, there's something deeply wrong with Kissinger, who someone that smart, but to use that power for bad, I guess. But the other thing I wanted to ask you is that we do have someone like Daniel Ellsberg in American history, someone who did stand up, someone who did take a chance. And, you know, we see little spurts of that today. But and Jamie did address this, and probably much better, about the apathy question. But does Ellsberg at any time think it's hopeless, because history has essentially repeated itself quite dramatically in the first decade of the 20th century? I mean, no one even thought this was possible. But let's be very honest. I mean, it happened twice this decade. First with the declaration to go, the authority to give the president to go to war in Iraq. But then you could also say that was repeated with the whole bailout scenario when the Congress just uniformly passed that and the ramifications of that. So it seems like our Congress, if Gravel says it's cowardly, it's always cowardly. I mean, you don't have anyone standing up. And does Ellsberg ever think it's hopeless? Does he ever think that this country is just going to always play cookie-cutter politics and everything?
One of the things I like about Dan Ellsberg now, because he's been an activist since this time, since the time of the Pentagon Papers, is that he doesn't wrap himself up with that question, is it hopeless or not hopeless?
Okay.
He knows that he derives personal energy from being involved in activism. And, Howard Zinn makes a quote, something like that, right at the end of the film. That it changed his life. It changed Ellsberg's life. And he knows that being involved in the activism and trying to inspire other people and trying to move this country off a dime and trying to change policy gives you strength. And he hopes, and we hope, that other people see it the same way, and that's why they'll get involved and not worry about, oh, is this act that I might be doing today, worth it or not worth it?
No.
It's worth the doing.
And Dan will be 79 in April, and he's been arrested 79 times for civil disobedience, which Patricia calls his spiritual practice, which I like a lot. She's a Buddhist master, and Dan, this is Dan's own, his practice is getting arrested, which he seems to do pretty regularly. We've been with him a number of times arrested since we've been, working on this film. And, when he sees a good cause, he's more than willing to lay his body down on the street to try and stop the war or, nuclear testing or whatever he thinks is the wrong thing. So, I mean, that is really inspiring, being around someone who, and, he's called on constantly to speak in behalf of organizations trying to make change, and has been tireless and selfless traveling with us with this film, as has Patricia, his wife. So we've been incredibly lucky to have him with us and, the real guy.
Your film is very inspiring, and as we alluded to before, it does play like a thriller, and it has so many pieces of the story kind of jumbling together. And one important piece is the role of the press in Mr. Ellsberg's story with the Pentagon Papers. And we're looking at a very different press today, I think, and certainly part of that is economic, but also a responsibility of the media to the people. Do you think that has changed since the Pentagon Papers period to where we are today?
Yeah, it's changed dramatically, and it's changed dramatically for the worse. I was at a question and answer after the film last night in San Francisco, and one of the people in the audience brought up the Pfizer wiretapping story that the New York Times had in 2004, and basically it was a lot of illegal wiretapping by the Bush administration, and the Times sat on that story for months until after the election. They got a Pulitzer Prize for it, ironically, but the point was that, and I went to a forum where the managing editor of the Times, Bill Keller, was there, and he talked about meeting with people from the Bush administration while they had the story and discussing what was the correct way to put this out, or why could they do this, or timing and stuff like that. And, the people that you saw in the film, the Max Frankel and Hedrick Smith and Jim Goodale, they would have gagged on that attitude.
Of course.
You would actually meet with the government. They got a telegram telling them not to publish from the government. And as Goodale says in the films, what have we been fighting for 200 or 300 years if we're going to stop publishing just because somebody sends you a telegram? So I think that speaks to the difference, and it's the same news organization. It's the New York Times then and the New York Times now, and you see how dramatically they have changed, and I think that permeates the entire media in our country.
Well, the Fourth Estate becomes the propaganda arm, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good point.
It's disgusting, because I remember when that story broke, and if that story had originally broke when it was supposed to, the election of that year would have been, I would like to think, dramatically different.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the election turned on one state, and there's no question that story would have affected the election. There's no question.
Tell me how this movie is affecting people. It's playing in major cities right now. But yes. when you played the festival circuit and when you see it with audiences at the theatrical engagements that it currently has, what sense do you get from their reaction to it?
Well, one thing that has sort of surprised us is how well it plays with young people. And we I took it to Palm Springs to the film festival there, and they bussed in 1,000 kids from around the region for a screening, and we followed a comedy, and I thought, this isn't going to go well. But and at the end, you know, 1,000 high school kids and 100 hands went up with the most amazing questions. How can I be a better citizen? How can I get more involved? What can I do to make our government more responsive and transparent? I mean, they just got it at this gut level, walking in not knowing a whit about who Daniel Ellsberg was. And a couple weeks ago, Patricia and I were down at USC, and we showed it to Leonard Maitland's Maltin's class,
mm-hmm.
and big, 400 kids at USC. And this girl stands up, this young woman in the front row, raises her hand, and stands up and says, I'm from a very, very conservative background, she says, but as of now, I am a liberal. And I thought it was just amazing that people really are, I think, turned around by this film. And we've been sold out our hometown is playing in Berkeley at our local Shattuck Cinema, part of the Landmark chain, and we've
mm-hmm.
been sold out on weekend nights 5, 7, and 9, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Last weekend we sold out again last night.
Congratulations.
I don't know what tonight looks like, but it's really, yeah, it's going really well, and we'll be opening in about 60 cities in the next few months up to April. We're
oh, wonderful.
At the moment.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So it's going on.
Yeah,
so go to the website and you can see the play dates on the first. Well, if you go to our website, mostdangerousman.org, then that'll take you to the play dates on the first run features website, our
right.
distributor.
And it is in large cities, but it's also in small cities.
Yeah.
Okay.
Everywhere, right? Permeating the country.
Yeah.
Well, we will definitely.
Which is the point.
We'll definitely drive our listeners to your website, and it's God bless the young, because I even heard an interview with Mr. Ellsberg where he said, you know, we have a new generation, and that gives me hope.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're looking for heroes, and we got one.
Yeah.
You know, he's the real avatar.
Yeah, you're real, no, you're right.
Not
right.
in
What's
3D,
right.
not blue, but he's the real
right.
avatar.
That's an important analogy to bring. I mean, you're absolutely right. He is the Jake Sully. If you want to break it down to something that young people understand, yeah.
yeah.
If you want, that's
yeah.
a great way to sell it.
Well, someone wrote
that's
me
right.
an email and said that. I saw your film, but I didn't understand why Dan was blue and in 3D. you might just notice this is something that it's really struck us. You know this thing, a critical consensus? It's an assessment of the current motion picture critics around the country. We're number one in the country on that list.
Wow.
Avatar is number 10. We're number one. So it's not how big your budget is.
No, they have a bias against blue people, you know?
Yeah, exactly. They hate those. But I loved Avatar myself. It's not the kind of film I ever see, but I was dazzled by it. So it's not that I don't like Avatar.
Let me ask you this, though. As far as commercial cinema goes, blockbusters go, I think it is the most damning indictment of U.S. foreign policy ever presented in an American motion picture.
Avatar. Ours or Avatar?
Well, no, yours. No, yours.
Oh,
ours. For a narrative film, the one thing I couldn't get over... More so than anything else I'd ever seen, and that's a damning indictment of U.S. imperialism, if there ever was one.
Well, I think it's important. I think that's an important story to tell because we're in a global village, and the kind of cowboy mentality of the last administration, and even the kind of we'll solve things by military means mentality that continues today, that's got to change. That's not a change in this world. The world won't survive. We won't survive as a country. The world won't survive unless we figure out new ways to interact with other countries that don't involve sending in the troops.
Right.
Yeah. Judith, I asked Rick earlier before you got on the line,
mm-hmm.
Before we close up here, I just wanted to get your feelings with a week leading up to the Oscars. What's going on within you? Are you feeling anxious?
You know, it's anxious, a little anxious, a little, you know, I think a couple of weeks ago it just seemed like we were such a long shot. I mean, The Cove has been out for a year, so is Food, Inc. It's gotten a lot of press and attention, and we're kind of these latecomers, and I think people hadn't seen our film. And as people are seeing our film, I think that we're actually in the running, and it's a little scary because before it was like, oh, we'll have fun, and we're not going to win, and now it's, I think we have a shot at it. And it's exciting, and it's nerve-wracking, and I'd just love to see Dan Ellsberg up there inspiring another generation of people.
Is he attending with you guys?
Oh, yeah. He and Patricia will be with us. Yeah.
Oh, terrific.
And,
that's awesome.
And hopefully, yeah, maybe, and we don't know who's going to talk yet, but if it's just one of us, we're hoping it's Dan, or I'm hoping it's Dan. So we'll see. You know, it's a thrill. You know, the whole rigmarole of it is a little bit of a, you know, it's a little overwhelming, but but it's not, shouldn't complain. It's great. And the community here is all, I just noticed that, anyway, I'm having a dress made by a local designer who sort of enlisted everybody to help sew it. I think it's like the mice and Cinderella or something going on here. I didn't know it would come to this. But
do you get a sense, though, with the documentary filmmakers that you've spoken to, I'm sure you've spoken to the other nominees in this category, do you get a sense of community in the documentary film realm?
Well, there is a very strong sense of community in the Berkeley community of documentary makers. And, you know, I realized the other day, my five best friends, three of them have been nominated, and I was like, oh, I get to join the club. You know, we really have a very strong documentary film community here in Berkeley, and a lot of people work out of the Saul Zantz Film Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's great. I actually have gotten to know Robbie Kenner quite well and like him a lot, who made Food, Inc. And you know, the other filmmakers I've met because we've been at other festivals, but don't know them well, but they're certainly all, this tough competition. Those are all really good films this year, and it's not going to be, you know, we're up against some very good films.
It is a wonderful time for documentaries, and I think if we were talking earlier about the media and their responsibility to the people falling by the wayside, I think more and more people are looking to the documentary world,
mm-hmm,
to shed light on the stories that need to be told.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
right.
I think
documentary film has improved, gotten more sophisticated. Just the quality has risen,
mm-hmm,
so much in the last decade or so, and I think that's a good thing because then more people are going to come out to see the films because they're entertaining and they have important things to say. Every one of the films that's nominated is the five films in the best documentary feature category have important things to say.
They do.
Your film is astounding. It's one of the most astounding documentaries I've seen in years, and I really appreciate your commitment to making it and getting it out there, and congratulate you on the nomination, and I will be rooting for you. Both of us will be
on
Sunday night.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you so much.
Lovely talking to you. Great.
Likewise.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Okay, good conversation. Rick Goldsmith and Judith Ehrlich, the directors of The Most Dangerous Man in America, up for Best Documentary the Sunday night of the Oscars.
Yeah, definitely. Now, those categories, the documentary and the foreign films that we're talking about, theirs were, I think that you do have, the potential for maybe something different winning than what you'd expect. It's usually that way every year, but I think this year it may very well be that.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah.
Could be. Before we close tonight, we're going to close the show early, actually.
Okay.
Because we don't have another hour of material.
Hey, at least you're right.
Yeah. We mentioned the backlash against the Hurt Locker. Ironically, Avatar's probably gained a little momentum.
Mm-hmm.
But Cameron is suffering a backlash this week over what was to be his next project. It was based on a book that was just published on two pilots that transported and dropped the Hiroshima
bomb. Right, right. Tell us about this. I remember reading about this. What happened?
Well, the controversy is that the author admitted that this was to be Cameron's next film. He optioned the book. The writer's actually a friend of his that collaborated with him on Avatar.
Right, okay.
So he said that, this was probably along his lines in that it was an epic kind of historical drama,
mm-hmm,
but an intimate story of these pilots. So he the author, admitted that he fabricated one of the characters. And then the publisher started asking more questions, and the author could not substantiate his answers, could not accurately.
Oh, my God, okay.
So they pulled the book, the publishers did.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So Cameron's taking heat from veterans, which it's not his fault.
No,
he's taking heat from veterans this week for supporting the project. I don't know that he supports the project now that he knows that it's bogus.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not, I don't. Wow.
Yeah.
Well.
Well, that happens.
I don't expect him to really. I don't expect another movie from Cameron for quite some time.
So Cameron's decided to do A Million Little Pieces instead.
That's good. That is good. Very good.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, did you see you saw the Roger Ebert thing on Oprah?
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, very emotional. We were talking about that yesterday. I mean, that's wow.
Yeah, it is emotional.
And he got to hand it to him. I mean, he's very brave, and he's just a beautiful human being. I mean, to come out, and that was just really, it was, like I said, very emotional to watch.
Well, he gave his Oscar picks as part of the segment.
Yeah.
And, I mean, predictable along the line. Christoph Waltz. He said it was predictable.
Yeah.
Christoph Waltz, Monique, Jeff Bridges, Sandra Bullock, Hurt Locker, Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair, definitely, I mean, at least the acting categories, I think, boom, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that may be very well the way it goes, so.
All right, so Oscar, I will be in Dallas spooning with my girlfriend on the couch watching the Oscars. So, you know, I'm.
Yeah.
That's an exciting time.
There you go. Thank you for sharing that with all of us. I love that. And
tell me about you. You have a title.
Oh, yeah. We are, me and Francis, for our Things We Didn't Learn in Film School, we're doing Things You Didn't Learn at the Oscars. And this will be, I guess, available in a couple of days after we do it. But, you know, if you want to, and if you have Skype, you can call in and send messages to Francis on Facebook, Francis Abbey. And we're just going to be running commentary for 3 hours, 4 hours. And I will promise you this, it will be better than the actual thing. I promise that. This will be just mayhem. Let's just hope that they give us enough material to work with.
Just have a package of lozenges nearby, because that's a long time to talk.
Oh, it is a long time. That's a very long time.
Yeah. So I wish you a great Oscar night.
Likewise. Hope you have a good one. Thank you so much.
And same with everyone out there.
Yeah.
We'll be back next Wednesday. We're going to do a kind of Oscar recap, just our thoughts on the ceremony and the winners. And we'll also speak to the director of a new documentary called Tales from the Script. It's a documentary featuring interviews with about 50 screenwriters, including Paul Schrader and Frank Darabont and a bunch of people. It's an interesting conversation. And then we'll be back the following week with the latest episode of our new classic series on David Fincher 7.
That will be a good one.
And we've already got guests for that. So.
Awesome.
All right, man. We're going to have a mystery movie theme.
Oh, okay.
I'm all set.
All right, cool.
Okay.
All right. Good night, everyone.
That's what we'll close off with. Have a great Oscar weekend, guys.
Yeah, take care.
Bye-bye. And any minute now, we'll be playing this secret theme.